It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. As it becomes more and more difficult for young people to afford college, universities without large endowments sometimes struggle to stay afloat.
This has been the case with some of America's historically black colleges and universities, also referred to sometimes as HBCUs, which often don't have the same level of alumni giving that some top-tier universities might.
Also, at a time when America is reconsidering the need for affirmative action in higher education, some people question whether HBCUs aren't only viable, but whether they're actually relevant.
Here with us now is Adriel Hilton, director of the Center for African American Research and Policy and assistant vice president for inclusion initiatives at Grand Valley State University. Adriel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, part of what prompted this is we saw news that one of the colleges we're talking about, St. Paul, a small college in Virginia, recently announced that it's closing. And also a trustee at Howard University, one of the more famous historically black universities in Washington, D.C., says their financial situation isn't great, enrollment's down. Are historically black colleges and universities in decline?
Excellent question. I believe that enrollments are down at most or a number of significant of universities, not just HBCUs. But the point that should be made here is that these schools must compete for students. They must compete for the best and brightest. And if they don't have the rigorous programs that are in demand, if they don't have the labs, the technology, the resources, not to mention the excellent residence halls and classroom buildings, students are not going to come. These schools must be allowed to grow in order to compete for the best and brightest, regardless of race. In addition, you know, I'll give a rich example. Social workers will tell you that being deprived of nutrition, good medicine, or of love will most likely result in their decline, our decline, perhaps even premature death. That is why our schools are struggling. The state-sponsored study done in the state of Maryland, which I hope to discuss that study in the future, a few years ago by an independent panel of experts concluded that but for the desperate treatment of historically black colleges by the state of Maryland, these schools would undoubtedly be just as competitive and just as comparable as any school in the state. So if you are going on a hike in the morning and throughout the day before I don't let you eat, drink, or rest, you're not going to get very far in the next day's hike.
So you're saying in this study, the historically black colleges weren't getting the same kind of support as the rest of the universities?
Sure, sure. The report places the blames in reference to lacking of competitiveness, and they lack competitiveness because of the funding. The state of Maryland is now going through a lawsuit. I don't know if you all are familiar with the lawsuit that's currently taking place in reference to comparability and for parity for HBCUs versus the predominantly white institutions in the state of Maryland. So that's one state where the lawsuit is now waiting. They're in waiting pattern now to see what the result will be. But the goal is to get the HBCUs in the state of Maryland to be comparable and at parity to their white institutions.
That's Maryland. Do you think, while there may not be lawsuits elsewhere, do you think that similar things are happening elsewhere in the country?
I would say, in my opinion, yes. HBCUs have always done more with considerably less than their white counterparts. For example, the study also notes that HBCUs within the state do not have the latest university-wide technology and administrative systems to support graduate education, specifically doctoral education. And the panel, this expert panel, also concluded that Maryland HBCUs should have the type of support needed to render quality programs as well as exceptional doctoral programs with the accompanying resources necessary for programming and the facilities needed for research and development like their predominantly white equivalents. So this is not new to higher ed in terms of comparable funding and parity. This has been going on since the beginning of time in reference to funding of institutions in the higher ed landscape.
Let's go back in time a bit to why these, what we now know as historically black colleges and universities, were created in the first place. I imagine it's to provide higher learning to people, black people in the United States who wouldn't be accepted into most colleges and universities that existed.
That's correct. You know, HBCUs were created to give blacks entree to a formal education that was not allowed at predominantly white institutions. In the years prior to the Civil War, white slaveholders resisted efforts by blacks to educate themselves. Even in the North, where slavery was almost non-existent, white inaction toward the education of blacks had much of the same result. So pre-Civil War blacks were allowed to enroll in only a few white private universities in the North, and those were such as like Harvard University, Amherst, and Dartmouth, as well as Oberlin. But they limited places where the students were enrolled and where they could live. So therefore, these students, persons of color, African Americans, blacks, were not allowed access to the predominantly white institutions or traditionally white institutions. Therefore, HBCUs were founded.
Well, and now, of course, colleges, universities around the country are not white only. They don't completely exclude black Americans. What is the role now of these historically black colleges and universities? Like, are they still relevant to the United States in this era?
Sure. Well, with many of today's predominantly white institutions choosing to be more selective in their admission practices, the majority of students generally classified as average and those who are considered less prepared for higher ed will undoubtedly be overlooked and passed over for opportunities to get a college education in the absence of HBCUs. So they're definitely relevant. So HBCUs tend to have more forgiving admission policies. And without HBCUs and their unique mission to provide an education to the average student through remedial or other special programs, a significant number of students would not be able to attend college or have access. As well as giving the financial status of many of the students who enrolled in a typical historically black college, most of these students would not be able to fund their educational expenses at a predominantly white institution or traditionally white institution.
Now, you are an alumnus of historically black colleges and universities, a couple of them, I believe. What was the experience like? What was it like going to those schools?
Sure. So I attended Morehouse College for my undergraduate studies and Florida A&M for my master's. And I did my PhD at Morgan State University. And the experience was second to none. The degree programs were indeed challenging, and the rigor was present. The faculty at these institutions were experts in their field and were published extensively throughout the higher ed landscape. They also challenged me not to settle and gave me confidence that I would succeed and would be successful. And as a young black male scholar practitioner, you know, I have witnessed the benefits of attending these institutions as they prepared me for the world of work and for my future goal, which is to become a senior-level administrator at a college or university. So I would say these institutions were welcoming and that they felt like a family environment, and that's always cited in the higher ed literature. If you read articles tied to historically black colleges, students always note that it felt like a family-like environment. They had great mentorship, great persons to go to and speak with at length to get them to succeed or to provide help or aid or service to the students.
You talked about what we in the United States would lose if some of these schools closed. Would you feel a personal sense of loss if we see more schools follow this St. Paul's lead and announce that they're closing?
I would say if HBCUs were to close, the nation could not meet the stated goals by President Obama, which he hopes that the United States is the number one developed country. Currently, the United States ranks 12th. So a country's rank depends on multiple variables, including the number of people with college degrees. So the United States rate of like 41.6% of people ages 25 to 34 with an associate's degree of higher, that's where we currently rank. So if HBCUs, they have an extraordinary role to play, not only in the manpower of training and economic development, but also in providing broad educational access and institutional choice, promoting diversity in the workforce, and in upholding the dignity of this nation as an exemplar of racial tolerance and social justice. So the impact would be the same as taking away any major anchor in any community. That community is diminished by the loss. It would be similar to, I'm currently residing in West Michigan, and if I drive to the east side of the state, the automobile plants that close in Detroit, or in Ohio, or the steel mills shutting down in Pittsburgh and in Baltimore. I've resided in Pittsburgh. I attended Carnegie Mellon, and I also resided in Baltimore. So I saw the lasting impact and effects of the steel industry shutting down. So we all know what happened in those areas, and those climates now are trying to rebuild those cities. So it will be the same in our nation.
Adriel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Adriel Hilton, Director of the Center for African American Research and Policy, Assistant Vice President for Inclusion Initiatives at Grand Valley State University.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at an effort to keep alcohol out of the hands of repeat offenders. Wisconsin's No Serve List, that's coming up on Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, Janesville is the latest Wisconsin community to adopt a no-serve list, a list of people who shouldn't be sold alcohol in taverns and liquor stores in the area because they've had three or more alcohol-related incidents.
We want to know what you think about this, this no-serve list. Is it fair? Would you like to see this in your community? Is it in your community? How is it working? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And here to explain how the list works is Jim Palmer. He's Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Hi, Jim.
Good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Good to have you here. Well, tell us about this no-serve list. How does it work?
Well, essentially, Chapter 125 of the Wisconsin State Statutes provides a number of grounds for which an establishment like a tavern, a bar, or a liquor store can lose its liquor license. And one of those provisions states that if one of these establishments sells alcohol to someone who is a habitual drunkard, that's one of the offenses for which they could lose their license. Now, the statute, unfortunately, does not define what it means to constitute a habitual drunkard. And so we've seen a number of communities, just recently, Janesville obviously just very recently, that have tried to enact policies, at least their police departments have, to maybe give this law some teeth and put it to work. And so what Janesville has done is, their policy provides that any individual who has three or more alcohol-related incidents that result in a police call within a six-month period are placed on a no-serve list. And if the person wants to contest the decision by the police department to be placed on that list, he or she can appeal to the city's Alcohol License Advisory Committee.
Now, does this mean that the person would have to be known by face when they go in? Are we assuming they're going to keep going back to the same place to get their alcohol?
Well, I think what would happen is every establishment within the city of Janesville would receive this person's name and, if possible, of some kind of photo identification. And that establishment, to the best of its ability, would have to stay on top of that and try to avoid selling that individual an alcoholic item.
And I suppose the bartender, the liquor store person, they just say, sorry, you're on the no-serve list, and that should be that?
That's correct. And the list would be updated every 6 months. And if someone does not have three police contacts in those 6 months, the person would be dropped from it. So it'd be updated every 6 months.
Every 6 months. Okay, so they can be removed. Can they ask to be removed from the list once you're on it? Is there any way to get off?
Yes, they can appeal to the Janesville Alcohol License Advisory Committee and try and make the case as to why they shouldn't be included on that list.
So what happens?
That is a little distinct from, there are two other communities of which we are aware that have similar policies. One is Green Bay, where an individual, if they have three or more alcohol-related incidents in a year, such as public intoxication, disorderly conduct, something of that nature, they are placed on that list for a period of 1 year. And if they can go a 12-month for 12 months without having any further instances of requiring police contact, then they are taken off of that list. The last city that has such a policy is the Madison Police Department, and they basically provide that in order to get on the list, a person would have to either be arrested or convicted of a crime while intoxicated or taken to treatment at least six times in the previous 6 months. And so there are some, it's clear that there are a few municipalities and their police departments that are trying to tackle this issue from a few different angles, and it will be interesting to see how this continues. I do think, in our view, that this will be a part of a larger trend.
Jim, tell us why you think this is necessary, why it's a good idea.
Well, I think, you know, I don't think it's really debatable that the abuse of alcohol in Wisconsin is a enormously prevalent problem. And, you know, one of the things that the messages that, a city police department sends when it adopts such a policy, I believe, is it helps highlight how much public resources are spent dealing with alcohol-related incidences. Also, I think it helps promote a better sense of shared responsibility amongst tavern owners and liquor store owners. So I think it just recognizes that this is a statewide and community problem, and there's more that we can do collectively and collaboratively to address it.
And apparently this wastes a lot of police time, too, it sounds like, when you have to pick someone up and, I guess, wait around for them to be processed and detox.
Absolutely. I mean, a single call can sometimes take the better part of a shift, especially if someone has to go to detox. You know, that officer oftentimes is required to remain there until that person comes down to an acceptable level. And so it does really require a great deal of resources, and I think it's an important message to get out to the public and remind people.
Now, on the other hand, you know, how does this square with, you know, someone's own personal autonomy being the decider of whether or not they want that next drink or not?
Well, certainly that's the case. I at the same time, if you've had, I think the public policy argument against that is that, listen, if you've shown a severe propensity to consume alcohol and it requires a frequent number of police contacts, I think that's a right that you're going to forfeit to some extent. And I think that's a legitimate position for a government to take.
So tell us about the Tavern League. What have they had to say about this?
Well, in Janesville, the police department, in formulating this policy, did reach out to the Tavern League, which was a great decision. And I know that there was a lot of discussion about how do we define in this policy what it means to be a habitual drunkard. And I think there was a lot of discussion regarding whether or not this list would include OWI offenses. And I think they determined that list would probably be, regrettably, too large and probably too difficult for tavern owners and liquor stores to manage in any effective way.
Well, how optimistic are you that this is going to solve Janesville's alcohol problems? You said Green Bay already had a program similar to this in action. Madison has one as well. What are we seeing?
Well, so far what we've seen is that, you know, in the places where it has been tried, there have been a reduction in the number of police calls to that area. So I think that's a positive result. I mean, certainly it's not a panacea, and I don't think anyone in any of these police departments thinks that that's the case. But clearly it's an effort, and I think a genuine one, to try and do more to combat the abuse of alcohol in our communities.
Now, in terms of going back to the Tavern League, they have said they're looking into questioning the legality of laws like this, these no-serve lists. What do you think about that? Do you think that it is getting into a gray area here with the law?
I clearly think it is a gray area. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, the law does provide that, you know, liquor stores and taverns should not be selling alcohol to habitual drunkards, but it doesn't. The same statute does not define what that means, and so it is absolutely a gray area. And you know, whatever action the Tavern League wants to take, I think that will help forward the discussion. And if it requires legislation to clarify this, I think that's probably not a bad result either.
Do you have a sense of how no serve lists are working in other states?
I don't. I think this is a relatively new approach that we're seeing. And like I said, I think it's going to become part of a larger trend throughout the state.
And what do you think about enforcing it in terms of, you know, being that liquor store owner who's got someone there, you know, or a bartender, they want that next drink. Is it going to put them in an uncomfortable position that, you know, maybe someone else needs to help them with? If you've got someone who's belligerent, who's out of control, what do you think?
Well, if someone's in an establishment and they're being belligerent and it's alcohol related, certainly, you know, I'm sure the law enforcement authorities are going to be contacted just as they would today. And so I don't know how big of a problem that is. But I think clearly there's a need for more to be done in this area. And I think this is a genuine effort on the part of a few police departments to, you know, really start a public discussion like this one. And I think it's just an outstanding debate to have. And I think it highlights not only how large of a problem alcohol abuse is in this state, but how much it the problem requires in terms of public resources to address it and the problems that it creates.
All right, Jim, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me on.
We were just talking with Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association.
Well, you've been listening along, and now we want to hear what you think. Do you think this no-serve list is a good idea? Would you like to see it in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you work at a tavern or a liquor store? What would you think? Would you feel comfortable enforcing this thing? 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll take your calls after the news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We've been talking about Janesville as the latest Wisconsin community to adopt a no-serve list. It's a list of people who aren't to be sold alcohol in taverns and liquor store in the area when they've got three or more alcohol-related incidents within the last 6 months.
Janesville joins Madison and Green Bay in doing this no-serve list. And now we want to know what you think. Would you like to see something like this in your community? Is it in your community? Do you live in one of those areas? Do you think it's a good idea? Do you work in a liquor store or a tavern? Would you feel comfortable enforcing this? Call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@WPR.org, or comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And let's take a first caller now. We have Michael in Fond du Lac. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, what do you think about the no-serve list?
I guess my prime fear of it is just becoming too intrusive over time. I just kind of feel it's a step away from going into a bar, them sliding your ID and, you know, yes or no, we don't think that you should have a beverage. And I think that there should be more personal accountability.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Michael. We'll go now to John in Windsor. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, and let me preface this by saying that I haven't had an alcoholic drink in 30 years, but I absolutely am appalled that the police departments of these communities are making this decision. If it was something that was passed through a city council via ordinance or through the state legislature, I would not have an issue with it. But if it is the police unilaterally saying, well, we think we're going to have a no-serve list, that is a problem as far as I'm concerned.
All right, John, thank you so much for the perspective. And let's go next to William, who's joining us in Green Bay. Hey, William.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing good.
Thanks for taking my call. Just out of curiosity, do you think America will ever get serious about not drunk driving? I mean, it seems to me that they just let it go on and on and on to make revenue, to make money. If they were serious about not letting, wanting people to drunk drive, they would go the way of Norway or Sweden. The first DWI, you lose your license for a year. The second, you never drive again. And they have a much, much, much lower rate of DWIs over there.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for calling in, William. A line or two is opened up now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you want to join in on this idea of a no-serve list, a list being given to bars, taverns, same thing, I guess, liquor stores saying, hey, these people have committed a lot of alcohol-related crimes. Don't sell booze to them. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email talk@WPR.org.
And Adam on Facebook says, we have this in Madison. I can't speak to the effectiveness of the no-sell list because I've seen no statistics. I will say I don't enjoy confrontations with potentially dangerous people the police, quote, don't have time to deal with. Also, here in Madison, bars aren't required to use the list and can serve the people on it all they want.
Thanks a lot, Adam. We've got a call now from Jim in Waukesha. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Personally, I can never see it being enforced. Being a bartender on a busy Friday or Saturday night, there's just no way you're going to stop between each drink to compare somebody's face to a pitcher. And, I mean, it seems a lot a lot of wasted time and ridiculous, if you ask me.
But, Jim, if you're working in a bar, I mean, if some of these people are showing up in this list, maybe they're regulars, they're people who show up all the time. Maybe you would have cut them off anyway. I don't know.
Then that would be the case. If they're regulars, you would have cut them off anyway. But so don't come, I mean, to come up and having people come in the bar and before each drink, having to page through a list of pitchers to compare pitchers, I just don't see it ever happening.
Gotcha. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective from behind the bar.
And we move to Linda in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello.
I think it's very important that we do create some restrictions that make it harder for people to drink and drive. But the reality is, if we create this type of restriction, it's just going to create a black market for alcohol, the same way it does for marijuana and guns. The people who want to get it will get it, but it's going to end up being an illegal activity versus the way it is now administered.
Thanks a lot, Linda. Time for a couple more calls. We've got Carrie with us in Milwaukee. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I think it's a good idea, but kind of like the last caller, if you start making it illegal to do in certain areas only, you're going to just cause people to drive farther and then go to bars in different towns and then drive home drunk, which isn't really solving anything.
So if this happens in Janesville, I'll just go to Beloit and get some drinks.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call, Carrie.
Okay, thanks to Carrie. Next to Sean in Madison. Hi, Sean.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good. I guess my viewpoint on it is if you're in your first offense, I believe that no-serve list shouldn't apply to you. However, if you're going to have your second, third, or fourth offense for the drunk driving, you haven't learned your lesson, and I believe you should not be served. You obviously can really hurt someone, hurt yourself, and you know, so on. But I believe the no-serve list should be applied for the second, third, fourth offense, and so on for drunk driving.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. We've got Patrick in Toma now. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, how are you doing?
Real good. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. In respect to this thing that they want to put into effect, La Crosse had this at one time up until about 1958. And it was at that time the police department used to take pictures of violators that were people that were picked up for public drunkenness and drunk driving. And they actually had the pictures on the cash registers of every bar of do not serve this person or whatever have you. And that was challenged, I believe, and that became unconstitutional. You'd have to go back in the books to see that. And then later on, public drunkenness was actually removed from the books as being unconstitutional because it was a misdemeanor or whatever have you. So then they changed that law so that the individuals who were highly intoxicated were taken to detox centers. So it's not a personal level that we all have to be responsible for ourselves, you know. We can't be a nanny state and be watching everybody all the time.
All right, thanks a lot for the call. And we've got Jonathan in Milwaukee bringing us on home. Jonathan, hi.
Hi, how y'all doing?
Real good. What do you think of this?
I think the personal accountability is a great idea. The cops trying to police everything that we do, people can always go out and find somebody else to buy the drink for them. There's always somebody, pay $2-3 to some younger person and get them to buy the drink for you, or drink at home and then drive somewhere with the intent to get more and get more trouble. You can always go somewhere else and have somebody else buy the drink for you.
All right. Well, thanks so much for your thoughts, Jonathan. Thanks for calling in. We've been talking about Janesville's no-serve list, a list of people who shouldn't be sold alcohol in taverns and liquor stores if they've had 3 alcohol-related incidents. We've been finding out what you thought for the past 15 minutes, and thank you so much for all the calls.
A lot of interest in that, and you can still post on the Central Time Facebook page to let us know what you think. Coming up next, we'll learn some wacky facts about rejection. Like if you take some Tylenol after being rejected, you might actually feel a little better. Weird. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. We've all faced rejection at some point or another in our lives from a potential employer or maybe a boyfriend or girlfriend, you name it. It's never fun. Our guest wrote a new Psychology Today piece, 10 Things You Didn't Know About Rejection. Licensed psychologist Guy Winch is with us, author of Emotional First Aid, Practical Strategies for Treating Failure, yes, Rejection, Guilt, and Other Everyday Psychological Injuries. Guy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I teased a little bit earlier that Tylenol, apparently, according to what you wrote, can help relieve the pain of rejection. And I my question for you is, what?
Yes, I didn't make that up, even though it sounds as though I did. What people did in the research is they tried to understand why rejection does hurt so much. So they put people in fMRI machines, the brain scan machines that can look at what happens in their brain as they're thinking or doing certain things. And they had them relive really painful rejection experiences. And what they found, to their surprise, mind you, was that the same areas of the brain light up when they were reliving the rejection as light up when we experience physical pain. And they concluded that the rejection pathways in our brains piggyback on the pathways that get activated when we experience physical pain. And one of the ways they tried to verify that was by doing a study in which they gave half the people Tylenol and half the people sugar pills and put them through a rejection experience, and indeed found that those receiving Tylenol reported less emotional pain than those who did not.
Wow. So the way our brain feels rejection is comparable, similar to the way we feel physical pain.
Absolutely.
And how about the memories of that pain? Which sticks with us worse, the physical or that emotional pain of rejection?
Well, there, the rejection wins out, in fact, because if you try and recall an experience that was really physically painful, you're going to have a very hard time generating that same level of visceral anguish, of real pain. You can recall it was painful, but you won't really feel pain. However, and I don't recommend you do this, but if you try to recall a really painful experience of rejection, you're going to get really upset by recalling that, by really replaying that. You're going to feel rejected in the moment and feel really upset and feel very similarly to the way you did at that time. So we can recall rejection much more vividly than we can recall the pain of just physical pain.
Now, why do you reckon we do that? Why did we evolve that way?
We evolved that way because in our past, when we were, cavemen and hunter-gatherers, being ostracized from our tribe was basically a death sentence. People couldn't survive alone. They had to survive in tribes or groups, hunting groups, tribes, whatever. And so we developed this early warning mechanism to alert us if we are in any kind of danger of being, kicked off the island, voted off the island, rather, as it were. And that mechanism really had to get our attention. So when we were rejected, those people who responded to rejection by really taking note, because it was so painful, had an evolutionary advantage because they could then correct their behavior and avoid being kicked out of the tribe.
So in the same way that our pain response to something hot is protecting us from being burned, our response to being rejected saves us from being alone and dying as a result?
Yes, in terms of our evolutionary past, a few thousand years ago, 10, 15,000 years ago or more. But even today, there are really severe consequences for being rejected because one of the other things I write about in my book is loneliness, and that's sometimes a consequence of rejection. And what happens with loneliness is that actually lowers our lifespan. It's as risky for our health as smoking, in a way. So rejection, even today, has some very severe consequences that we should avoid, and that's why that mechanism is still operating as powerfully as it is.
I've been thinking back, and contrary to your advice, I did think about past moments of rejection and sort of relive those a little bit. And I think about, say applying for a job that you don't get. I remember feeling kind of irrational, like, what? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with you? Why didn't you give me this job? Why did you reject me? How does rejection throw us out of whack like that so that I feel that way?
Well, in fact, because of the pain that it causes, and our general reaction to rejection is that, it really throws us for a loop. And studies, again, when they ask people to recall a painful rejection and then subsequently ask them to do IQ tests, and then these are the second rounds of IQ tests, they actually scored lower, significantly lower on IQ tests, on tests of decision-making, on all kinds of concentration tests. In other words, it really does scramble our thinking. It scrambles our brains a bit because of the pain that we feel. And actually, when we're in physical pain, you'll probably find something similar, that somebody who's actually experiencing physical pain in the moment, not reliving the memory, but actually in pain, is probably not going to do that great in an IQ test either, because that's not where their mind and their concentration is going to be. So because we sit with that pain of rejection for so long after it happens, it really does a number on us. And again, part of the reason I wrote this book is because we're not aware that this is the case. We think there's something wrong with us for feeling so hurt because even a mild rejection really stung. But it's not you. There's nothing wrong with you if a rejection causes you, you know, a really strong emotional reaction. That's how we're wired, and that's how all of us are wired. So it's not you.
Well, but yeah, we can say, oh, it's not me. But isn't there part of our brain that's not really open to reason, that's just irrational at that point? How can we work around that?
Well, I think knowing that, knowing, for example, about this research, that it piggybacks on pain pathways, that that's why it's so painful. I mean, there really is no other emotion like that that's that painful. If you're embarrassed, you feel that in the moment, but you don't feel that kind of level of pain, you know. But knowing that that's what happens in our brains can help us understand what's happening to us, primarily so that we don't go and overgeneralize what happened to reach sweeping conclusions about ourselves that are very critical and very incorrect. Because that's something we're really likely to do, to really conclude that what's wrong with me, if you didn't get the job, you must be a bad candidate, you don't have the right skills, why would anyone want to hire you? I'm not suggesting that you thought those things, but
no,
people do. Well, okay, but people do in those scenarios, and it's a natural response. But if you knew at the time that thinking that was a natural response, but it was distorted, it was not true, it was being, those thoughts were being dictated literally by your brain because you're still reeling from the impact of the rejection, then you can start to actually do things like be very specific about what happened. Specifically, that one job rejected you in that one moment. And for reasons you're not aware of, it could be that there was an inside candidate that was going to get the job anyway and you never had a chance of getting it. It could have been you were number two on the list and you just missed out. It could have been there was one small thing on your resume that really they didn't like. Or it could have been that your graduate school or your schooling was one that they had an issue with a previous candidate, so they want to avoid that institution. There can be 101 reasons, if you want to think about it, about why you might get rejected both from a job and by a person, and really in any circumstance. So to conclude that it was something significant about you without any clear evidence of that is just faulty, and we need to remember that when we're going through these very painful emotional experiences.
You know, my example is fairly small, and I got over it pretty quickly, but it occurs to me, I mean, somebody could do something pretty stupid and possibly harmful when they're in this irrational state of rejection. Is this a cause for some of the headlines we end up reading later about somebody going on a shooting spree or something like that?
Well, actually, that's absolutely right, because we know that another one of the things that rejection does is that it really creates these surges of anger and aggression. And, for example, one of the studies they did, they had people go through a rejection experience, and then there was a confederate who was posing as a lab assistant, and a kind of bungling, you know, lab assistant who wasn't doing that well, and they gave the people who were rejected an opportunity to give feedback about the lab assistant after they were told that the lab job is very important for the livelihood of him and his family. And the people who got rejected started giving feedback that would get that person fired, and he had done nothing to them. He was just around. In other words, we'll take out our aggression on innocent people. We'll go home to our families and be really nasty to our parents or to our wife or to our husband or to our children because we're so angry and irritable about the rejection. But in the extreme situations, a lot of violence against women by men is done because of rejection. A lot of times when people, you know, quote-unquote, go postal, it's that, you know, the scenario is the postal worker got fired and went postal. You know, they were rejected and they went postal. And there's even some evidence that in Columbine, that tragedy that happened in 1999, one of the people at least was dealing with really severe rejection experiences. And so rejection is and can be a great instigator for violence. And some studies have found that it's a bigger cause of adolescent violence than gang affiliation or drugs even.
Wow. That's pretty impressive. I had no idea that rejection was such a powerful thing. Well, can you take us through? You gave me some advice in dealing with my past situation, but can you give people a little checklist next time you face rejection? What are a couple of things they should do? Should they start with some pain medication?
Look, the Tylenol does a little bit, but no, I would start with the following. First of all, I would really recognize that the emotional responses you're having in those moments are extreme because of how you're wired, not because there's anything wrong with you or because you're so fragile or breakable. We all respond that way. So to recognize that the pain you're feeling, the anger you're feeling, the confusion you're feeling, the bad decisions you might make, that's all part of the deal. Now, what you need to do to feel better is, first of all, get support from people who really value you and who really love you and who can give you that message. Because, you know, imagine back in the old days that we were about to be booted out of our tribe. We need our tribe to tell us that, no, we're not booting you out. You're valuable. You're wanted. So reconnect with your family. Reconnect with a core circle of friends. Reconnect with a core circle of college buddies or of work friends that really know you, love you, accept you, and value you. Do that. Then argue very much with any negative thought you have that's general beyond the very specifics of the situation. And the specifics were, that person didn't want to go out with me, that one specific person, or that specific job didn't hire me, or that specific friend didn't invite me to their party, or that specific person didn't like my post on Facebook, whatever it is. Keep it very specific. That's the one thing that happened. Don't generalize it. Don't conclude any self-critical things from it. Keep it as specific as possible and remind yourself of all the good qualities you have, of all the good friendships you have, of all the good skills you have as an employer that other people would value, just not that one specific one, and probably for all kinds of reasons that have nothing to do with you.
Would we be better off without this this reaction that we have to rejection nowadays? We're not living in a tribal society, and we know we need other people rationally to get by.
Well, you know, our emotions are really important because they really guide us in life. If you didn't have, if your emotional pathways were deactivated entirely, not that we can do that in any way, but if we could, you would have trouble making basic decisions like what you want to have for dinner and which shoes are you going to put on and where are you going to go after work, because there would be no emotional valence given to anything. It would all be the same. So we're stuck with our feelings, and it's good that we are because they're usually very helpful. But this is one example in which they're going to lead us a little bit astray, and we need to know that so we don't take them at face value.
Just in our last 30 seconds or so, are you excited about the state of the art in this research that you're talking about? I had no idea this was out there.
There is a lot of really exciting research going on in psychology, and especially in neuroscience, now that we have these imaging techniques, and we're learning really stunning things about a lot of very basic emotions and very basic human reactions. And in general, I wrote my book because so much of this was unknown at the time to me, and I think to most people, yet it's fascinating, and it has a big impact. We could use this in our lives. You could actually benefit from that knowledge and make it instrumental, and there are lots of takeaways. So, yes, I'm very excited about where this is going.
Guy, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
That was Guy Winch, licensed psychologist, author of Emotional First Aid, Practical Strategies for Treating Failure, Rejection, Guilt, and Other Everyday Psychological Injuries. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.